loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. The Trump administration has issued a new travel ban executive order to replace the earlier order. The earlier order banned people from 7 Muslim-majority countries. Now it's 6 Muslim-majority countries that will be denied entry into the United States, at least for a time. But will this executive order also be struck down by the courts? President Trump has ordered an investigation into alleged Watergate-style wiretapping he says was committed by the Obama administration during the election campaign against him. Is there merit to these accusations? China's National People's Congress opened over the weekend to chart the country's path forward amid economic uncertainty and a heightened level of tension with the United States. But first we turn to President Donald Trump has ordered an investigation into alleged Watergate-style wiretapping he says was committed by the Obama administration during the presidential election campaign. Is there merit to these accusations, which have dominated the media in the last few days since Trump made the allegations? We are joined from Maryland by legendary NSA whistleblower William Binney. Bill Binney was a technical director at the NSA for many years. Welcome back, Bill.
Glad to be back.
Thank you. Tell us what's behind the Trump wiretapping allegations. He tweeted on Saturday, quote, "How low has President Obama gone to tap my phones during the very sacred election process? This is Nixon Watergate, bad or sick guy," close quote. What's your reaction?
Well, I kind of think he hit it right on the head. I mean, but it's not just not limited. I mean, this collection is something that NSA has been doing on a very wide scale on everybody in the United States. I mean, they're using programs that tap into the fiber optic network all around the country in virtually every state of the union. They're taking in everything they possibly can off those fiber lines. That means phone calls, emails, file transfers, chatter, you know, web browsing, all of that. And it's done on a continuing basis. That's why they need to keep building bigger and bigger storage facilities. And, of course, we, the poor sucker taxpayer, have to pay for all of this. We have to pay for them to spy on us, okay?
But, Bill, let me just jump in and ask you. In his first tweet on Saturday, Trump wrote, quote, "Terrible, just found out that Obama had my wires tapped in Trump Tower just before the victory. Nothing found. This is McCarthyism." So he's not talking about what you're, I think, referring to, which is that the NSA has the capacity, the ability to listen and collect data on everyone's conversations and communications and go back in time. What he's saying is that Obama directly ordered the wiretap of Trump Towers.
I think what he's really talking about is ordering the direct interrogation of the NSA database for information off the taps on the Trump Tower. So in other words, all that stuff is being continuously tapped and stored. They have the capability, and they're actually doing it. So the point is that they have to direct people to go after individuals inside the country. So when they do that, that's a directed effort. So it's one thing to capture the data. It's another thing to interrogate it. And the targeting for him, he's probably thinking of tapping as going after him in the database. See what I mean?
Yes, I understand. So in other words, what he's saying, or what you're saying in interpreting his tweets, which, of course, it's not always necessarily that easy because they're very short. They're 140 characters or less. But in other words, NSA collects data on all of us, and then the president of the United States or some law enforcement official can then have a targeted investigation into somebody's communications. And if they were to do that, it's all there so that there could actually be, even going back in time, the ability to listen to all of those communications. That's what you think he means.
Yeah, that's what I believe he means, yeah. See, they don't actually have to tap it. I mean, they're already tapping everything, so they don't have to tap into it. But usually what they do is when they go to the FISA court, they get a ruling out of the FISA court that says, okay, here's a warrant, go get it. And that simply allows them to introduce that data in a court of law. Whereas if they simply went with the NSA data as it exists, they can't introduce it in a court of law because it wasn't acquired with a warrant. a violation of the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution.
Now, there's reports in the media, I've seen this in the New York Times and elsewhere, that before he issued his tweets, before he published his tweets, that Trump had been reading, along with other members of the White House, an article that was in Breitbart News, the company that Steve Bannon used to be the director of. And of course, Bannon is a top strategist in the Trump White House. That article quoted conservative radio host Mark Levin, who made claims on his Thursday night show about the alleged steps taken by the Obama administration to undermine Trump's campaign to win the White House. Levin called the effort a silent coup by the Obama administration and said that rather than the Trump's Russian ties, there should be an investigation of the Obama administration's conducts. Perhaps he read the Breitbart article. The media says that it was being shared within the White House staff. Do you think that that's the basis for his sort of very unprecedented allegations?
Well, I mean, it certainly could be. But also, you know, I think there's been reports of Hillary tweeting that there was, in fact, a connection between a server in the Trump Tower and a server in Moscow at a bank. So what that should tell everybody is that, you know, the people inside the intelligence community, which I now refer to as the Praetorian Guard, because they're trying to influence what the emperor does and also and probably try to influence who is emperor, as the Praetorian Guard did back in Roman times. This was before the election, and this told you that he had to tap on back then, too. And they were focusing on him, taking the data out of the databases at NSA.
Mike Hayden, who had been the director of the CIA and who obviously was an opponent of Trump's, he had been Obama's CIA director, he said this about Trump's tweets. "It looks as if the president just for a moment forgot that he was president," Hayden said on a Fox News interview on Monday. "Why didn't he simply use the powers of the presidency to ask the acting director of national intelligence, the head of the FBI, to confirm or deny the story he apparently read from the Breitbart News the evening before?" What do you think about Hayden's comments?
Well, I mean, certainly that was one of the options that the president had. If he wanted to do it that way, he could. It's really up to him. I think it was his decision to do it this way because he wanted the American public to know this. And I don't blame him. I want the American public to pay more attention to what the NSA is doing with their programs in the upstream collection program. You know, Fairview, Stormbrew, all of those tapping points inside the United States collecting data on U.S. citizens, content and metadata. And they're not really paying attention to that. They don't really realize what that means. Well, here is the case. Here you have the intelligence community acting like the Praetorian Guard back in Roman times, where they're going to determine who's going to be president, or they're going to make life very difficult for the president. I mean, that's why Senator Schumer said what he did, that the president should not be attacking the intelligence community because they've got many ways to get back at him. Well, here we go. This is exactly one of them. The point is that this kind of information shouldn't be allowed anywhere in our government at all because it's not acquired with a warrant and there's no probable cause on anybody. But it gives them the ability to have power over everybody. And that's something that the central government of the United States was never intended to have. We were supposed to be a country with a government, not a government with a country.
Bill Binney, is it possible that there could have been a wiretap, or however we want to characterize it now, because they don't, as you said, need to actually put a wiretap on. They already have the data because they have it. That's the NSA bulk surveillance collection. Is it possible that it was the consequence of parallel construction? And how do you think it could be possibly relevant to this case?
Well, I mean, they can use that data if they think they have criminal activity. They can use that to direct the state and local police or even the FBI to go after somebody and arrest them based on that data. But then they have to do what has been called a parallel construction. And the Reuters published the criteria and the rules for doing that for the Drug Enforcement Administration. Also, it's true for the FBI. It's directives out of the Department of Justice as to how to handle the NSA collection. And so they can't take it into court, so they have to do this kind of parallel construction, directing normal policing efforts to go after data like they normally would, then assemble that data and substitute it for the NSA data in a court of law. This is one thing that was basically the Solicitor General of the United States lied to the Supreme Court about this in the Amnesty International versus Clapper case, where he said that if anybody in a criminal prosecution was the NSA data was used against them, that they defended would be told so he could have the right to challenge discovery, that is, the discovery of information against him. That was an outright lie. Nobody's ever been told.
So just for our audience, I want to try to help, again, explain the concept of parallel construction. So NSA is listening to all of our phone calls. They're collecting all of our emails. It's complete 100% full spectrum surveillance collection, and that collection, that data is stored. If they come upon somebody, for instance, who has not as of yet been indicted or even subject to an investigation because there's no reasonable cause of suspicion that a crime is being committed, but they find someone, say, who's peddling drugs, who's selling drugs, they turn that information over to the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Agency. And then because the information isn't obtained in a legal way, actually, the DEA has to create a parallel construction. In other words, a parallel kind of an investigation so that the information then seems to have been the consequence of an actual DEA investigation based on probable cause that someone has committed a crime. Go ahead.
And I would add that when they substitute the NSA data with that data in a court of law, I call that a planned program perjury policy run by the Department of Justice of the United States, because it's perjury.
Right. So you have the as we now know, that law enforcement agencies had initiated their own investigations about alleged Russian intervention into the 2016 presidential election campaign. Under that basis, on the basis of that kind of an investigation, could there have been thus the use of some data collected there for a parallel construction type case being made to warrant or to justify the tapping or surveillance on Trump himself?
Yes, that could very well be. Yeah,
because we need to find some way to explain it. It's very unprecedented in American history, certainly in the last 100 years, where the president of the United States, who's in charge of the intelligence agencies, is actually accusing the outgoing president of using those same intelligence agencies to carry out what is essentially a dirty tricks campaign, a campaign that was directed against a political opponent of his party, the Democratic Party.
Yeah, but there is one case in recent history that was Richard Nixon, and he used the same three agencies, NSA, CIA, and FBI, and it was programs Chaos at CIA, COINTELPRO at FBI, and Minaret at NSA. And they were spying, of course, on U.S. citizens, people like Martin Luther King, John Lennon, and other U.S. citizens who opposed the Vietnam War. And that was what he was impeached for.
So it's not a huge leap, actually. I mean, this is not ancient history that we're talking about.
No, it isn't. No, that's right.
So James Comey, who is the director of the FBI, who garnered a lot of wrath from the Clinton campaign for announcing a week before the election that, based on the seizure of Anthony Weiner's computer at his home in New York, that they were going to reopen or restart the investigation into Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton blames that for her defeat, in fact. Comey thus became the scapegoat for the Democrats. But now Comey is saying that he wants the intelligence agencies to be able to come out publicly and say, the Justice Department, I mean, to come out and say, Justice Department headed by Jeff Sessions, to say that the allegations made by Trump in his tweet are in fact not true. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, I think the word-wise, I mean, specifically the president didn't say it the right way, but he is tapped and he was tapped all along. So he didn't say, you know, somebody ordered it. Well, I mean, this order goes back to Bush and Cheney, the program Stellar Wind. Now, Comey is well aware of the program Stellar Wind. I mean, his predecessor, Director Mueller, said that they were very happy to use the Stellar Wind program from 2001 on. And he did that in an interview with Bart Gellman in March of 2011.
What is Stellar Wind? Help the audience understand that one.
Stellar Wind is all of the domestic spying collection of NSA. So in other words, it's all the emails, phone calls, wiretaps, transcripts of phone calls, things like that. Anything pertaining to domestic spying that was held under the very close compartment of Stellar Wind.
When you were at the NSA, part of your job was to watch over and see what was happening in the Soviet Union, I believe.
Yeah.
Tell me if I'm wrong. The Soviet Union and the United States were at loggerheads. There was the Cold War. Both understood each other to be primary adversaries. That seemed to be coming to an end after the collapse of the Soviet Union. There seemed to be the possibility of a new day. And yet the adversarial relationship between the United States and Russia is so vast right now, so great, so deep. On the part of the United States, I would say, I don't see it coming from Russia that much. It's almost unparalleled even compared to Cold War times. What do you think?
They're trying to start a new Cold War. Why? Because for the military, industrial, intelligence, and governmental complex that's involved here, that means trillions of dollars in spending from taxpayers. I mean, if you start up a new Cold War, you have the arms race and all of this, and that's basically what they're all looking for and would be happy to have, because it means a lot more into their budgets and a lot more programming and empire building and so on in government. So I just think that we have a bunch of people in Congress and various other places who cannot change. So
do you think Trump might have been thus targeted because he had said he wanted to improve relations with Russia? In other words, if what you're saying is true, is that a Cold War or a hot war needs enemies and Russia's right there, Trump would seem to be threatening that scenario.
Yeah, he's a threat to that. Yeah, absolutely. You know, because he is a threat. He's a threat to everyone. The Democrats are so afraid that he's actually going to succeed at everything he's doing far, far better than anybody ever has up to date. And that will make them look really, really bad with all the policies they've had in place for the last 8 years. That's what they're afraid of. They're also afraid of, losing more seats around the country in state houses and in the House and Senate. So, and having Trump succeed will make that a very, very likely reality. And that's what they want to avoid. And the other part is they want to create a new Cold War. I mean, this is pretty obvious to me. I mean, it's pretty clear that they're all interested in a lot of money and feeding. They just start creating so much in terms of turmoil that it's really basically destroying the democratic process that we have here, that we used to have anyway.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking to Bill Binney. He was a technical director, a high official with great technical expertise at the NSA. He became a whistleblower and paid a heavy price both from the Bush administration and then the Obama administration. But Bill Binney is a truth teller. We're out of time. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. Donald Trump's new executive order, the new travel ban. We are joined by Trina Realmuto. She is an attorney with the National Lawyers Guild's National Immigration Project. Welcome, Trina.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for joining. Big news. The Donald Trump administration has come out with a new travel ban, this time targeting 6, not 7 Muslim majority countries. What's in the order, and do you think it's likely to be overturned as the last one was in multiple courts, or at least blocked in multiple courts?
Well, you know, this is a new order, and despite a few tweaks, the order is merely a continuation of the discriminatory policies first announced in the original travel ban. This supposed new policy is still going to bring our refugee program to a halt, and it will still prevent U.S. officials from granting visas to people who already have been subject to extensive vetting and national security-related screening simply because they are from one of the 6 Muslim-majority countries. And so while the ban does have some tweaks from the original one that we've seen before, it's really important that we view this order through the same lens as the initial travel ban. This order is still going to keep families separated who have complied with U.S. immigration laws and have been waiting sometimes for years to be reunited. And it's still going to bar immigrant students and workers who want to come to this country to contribute to our economy and our academic institutions. And it's going to do so based on national origin. And, you know, we believe it's just a shoddy cover for President Trump's longstanding desire to enact a Muslim ban. So I'm happy to talk a little bit about some of the factual differences between this order The previous one, one thing about this order is that it has an effective date. It's going to go into effect on March 16th at 12:01 a.m. And so the administration is, at least this time, not throwing this order out at 5 o'clock on a Friday. You know, there is a little bit of lead-in time until it becomes effective.
What about people who already have visas from these six countries? What happens to them? Last time, if you had a visa, it didn't matter. If you were a green card holder, it didn't matter. You just couldn't come. Can they come now?
The way the order is set, that it allows for some folks who have a valid visa from these countries or who have, quote, officially been scheduled for travel, if they're a refugee, to be able to enter the United States. And so, and it does importantly exempt existing green card holders from the ban. Like the previous ban, it is a 90-day, suspension on entry. There are going to be requirements from these six countries of documentation that they need to provide to the United States within this time period. And non-compliance could lead to an indefinite and extended and potentially permanent bar on entry for nationals of these United States. So something we should all be concerned about.
So the countries right now are Sudan, Syria, Iran, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. Now, Iraq was part of the group, but the Iraqi government, which is fighting alongside the United States government against Daesh or ISIS, so-called Islamic State, protested vehemently. And of course, there's a great deal of anti-American sentiment already in Iraq because of the occupation, the invasion, the occupation of 2003. So suddenly it's okay for Iraqis to come. I mean, it really shows something about how this is fundamentally political and not about national security, it would seem to me.
Absolutely. And if you read some of the justifications that the administration is putting out in terms of why all of a sudden Iraq is off that list, many of those justifications, if you just sort of laid out in your comments, obviously existed at the time the initial executive order was put out. There's nothing new about those points. The government is claiming now that negotiations took place with Iraq after the issuance of this executive order and they reached some type of agreement. But it does sort of show the absolute political nature of this ban. And also, I think the administration got a lot of bad press because many of the Iraqi interpreters had put their lives on the line for U.S. government forces in Iraq were subject to that prior ban. And so you can see that the administration quickly retract. But I would point out that, you know, for some of the countries on the list, it's going to be where we don't have that communication, as open communication with the government, it's going to be very difficult for these countries to, you know, provide such documentation and get themselves off the list. So I would say that this 90-day suspension could be much longer, and we could expect it to be much longer. And in all the while, individual families and employers will be kind of caught up in this government political bureaucracy, even though these individuals have already been subject to extreme vetting procedures and have nothing, you know, to do with this political.
Right. It's, again, politics, because 15 of the 19 hijackers, according to the U.S. government, who commandeered the planes and flew them into the World Trade Center or to the Pentagon, were from Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is not on the ban. I'm not advocating putting Saudi Arabia or anybody on a travel ban, but I'm just making the point that you can't really argue, as the Trump administration is arguing, that this is decisive to ban people from these countries instead of, say, other countries, because they represent such a terrible danger. Rudolph Giuliani, former New York mayor and also of somebody who was hustling for Trump, he went on TV after the executive order ban and said this was the Muslim ban and Trump was trying to make it, quote, legal. How did the seven countries become the targeted countries? It seems to me that that was in some ways a residue or leftover from the Obama years. Go ahead on that, if you would.
Well, right. I mean, they are trying to make a big deal about these being the same countries as Obama, you know, had identified. But in fact, when you look at the historical background here, there's never been a ban on immigrants or refugees from these countries. And Congress and the president decided that people who can, I mean, normally come to the United States without a visa, mostly folks from Europe, would have to get visas before coming to the United States, folks from these countries. So this sort of visa waiver program background, which these countries were sort of identified as needing to receive a visa and not being permitted to participate in the visa waiver program. And I would point out there are many countries that are not able to participate in the visa waiver program. This justification, I think we see Trump trying to tie this to Obama, but in fact we know the underlying animus behind this executive order is really to do with all the statements he made while campaigning about his desire to ban Muslims from the country. And so this justification and this attempt to link it to Obama is really just a red herring.
Sean Spicer, who is the press secretary for Donald Trump, tweeted, at POTUS has signed a new executive order that will keep the nation safe, and then tells people to go and read it. John Kelly, General John Kelly, who is the DHS Secretary, Department of Homeland Security, said after Trump signed the executive order, unregulated, unvetted travel is not a universal privilege, especially when national security is at stake. In other words, the whole thing here is being sold as keeping America safe. You are an attorney. You're with the National Lawyers Guild. You're also representing a case as part of a group of attorneys, I would presume, in a proposed class action in Seattle, Ali versus Trump. Talk about that case, because your argument is that this isn't about national security. This is about trampling over people's basic fundamental constitutional rights.
Absolutely, and I'm happy to talk about the Ali case. I'll just sort of preface and add to your comment about the, quote, safety component of this, and I do put that strongly in quotes, because these policies ignore two Department of Homeland Security memos that directly contradict this security argument. This administration is pushing forward with a policy that fuels anti-American sentiment abroad and gives ammunition to basically to others. This is a reckless action, and it's dangerous for our security, but it also undermines, you know, our leadership on the world stage. And those documents, I think, are out there sort of explaining that simply being foreign-born doesn't add to a propensity to radicalize, and that, you know, folks who come here as children, who grew up in the American system are potential, have the same potential. But with respect to, so we don't think this is about security. We don't think that the country was not safe before Trump was inaugurated. What we think that this is about is this underlying discriminatory animus towards the Muslim religion and nationals of these six countries. And in our case, Ali versus Trump, in the Western District of Seattle, we are seeking to represent individuals who are involved in the immigrant visa process. And that is a process whereby individual U.S. citizens or lawful permanent residents are petitioning to bring their close family members, or U.S.-based employers are petitioning to bring their employees to the United States to reside permanently. And so this is an immigrant visa process. There is a statute that Congress passed that said you cannot discriminate based on national origin with respect to the immigrant visa process. We think that this executive order absolutely discriminates against people based on their national origin. And we are asking the district court in Seattle to enjoin this executive order. Well, we asked them to enjoin the prior executive order. We'll be asking the district court to enjoin this particular order. And we are before Judge Robart, who is the same judge that previously granted the national temporary injunction that was affirmed by the Ninth Circuit with respect to the previous executive order.
Let me just ask you about the legal action by Judge Robart. The original ACLU injunction, I think that came in New York, it seemed to me to be based on a very narrow ask to the court. In other words, it was about, I believe, people who already had visas and were on their way. In other words, it wasn't a broad constitutional challenge. There were other challenges in Boston, then in the state of Washington. Based on Robart's this earlier decision for the earlier executive order, how optimistic or pessimistic are you, if you have any opinion, that the judge will see in the new executive order the same fundamental flaws? Or was his ruling also narrow enough that it didn't take up these kind of issues?
You're right about the case in New York. It was brought by the ACLU, and it did sort of seek to keep people here who were caught up in the, not to return people who were in transit and who were arriving on our shores and being unlawfully detained in airports under horrendous conditions. The Judge Robart ruling that enacted the temporary restraining order, which was subsequently affirmed by the Ninth Circuit, took up some overlapping issues. The court was clearly concerned with the potential for discriminatory animus against Muslims and some of the due process concerns in that executive order. The Ninth Circuit also affirmed that ruling, basically saying we think that the plaintiffs, in that case the state of Washington, the state of Minnesota, had met their burden to show that there was a likelihood of success that they would prevail on those claims. But those claims have never reached full merit resolution. And in our case, there's an important statutory claim, the claim I was talking to you about how Congress basically said no national origin discrimination in immigrant visa process, that claim was not addressed in the prior litigation, and we will be asking Judge Robart to address that claim in Alley versus Trump, which the National Immigration Project of the National Lawyers Guild is bringing along with the Northwest Immigrants Rights Project and the American Immigration Council.
So what will happen now? Will there be a move for another temporary restraining order or an injunction against this executive order while these other claims are being pursued? What just help us in the last minute understand what's next in the legal battle?
Sure, absolutely. I think you will see the immigration community, civil rights community, human rights community go back to the district courts to amend the existing complaints to challenge this new executive order. And I think you'll see the courts react and respond to those lawsuits. There's been many lawsuits filed related to the travel ban, and this executive order is fully subject to challenge and will be challenged, I'm confident, in our lawsuit and as well as the other lawsuits that have been brought across the country.
Okay, and we'll see, too, whether people, not in the courts but in the streets, will go into the streets or, in the case of the first travel ban, go to the airports. Of course, the drama of that moment was such that the entire country, in fact, well, not the entire country, but people all over the country went to airports, especially international airports, to make it plain that people, aside from the law and aside from what's happening in the courts, people thought this was an outrage. But we'll see how that plays out, too. We've been joined by Trina Realmuto. She is an attorney with the National Lawyers Guild National Immigration Project. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. China's National People's Congress opened over the weekend to chart the country's path forward amid economic uncertainty and a heightened level of tension with the United States. We are joined from London by Keith Bennett. He is an expert on China who has visited the country hundreds of times and who advises both Chinese and British companies. Welcome back, Keith.
Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for joining. Tell us about the opening of China's National People's Congress. Talk a little bit, if you would, about what the Congress is. On the first day, Premier Li Keqiang delivered an address which some would say is similar to the U.S. State of the Union address in the U.S. What did he say?
Right. Well, the National People's Congress is generally described as China's parliament, and it meets in session for about 2 weeks every year around this time. So it's different in that sense from a Western parliament in that it's not in permanent session. People are not really full-time parliamentarians. They have other jobs or they play other roles in life, and their job is really to represent a two-way representation, really, from the government to the people and the people to the government, actually, in what they do through the rest of the year. And it starts off with premier's. It's called the work report. So I guess a State of the Union address is a reasonable analogy. What happens in that report is then discussed in small group sessions during the rest of the time, and amendments are made to it, and then the final version, often with some, probably not fundamental, but considerable amendments, is presented. Is adopted at the end of the session. Before we get to this point, this report will have been through hundreds of drafts in terms of being considered at local people's congresses, because besides the National People's Congress, you have local congresses going right down to the most grassroots and village level, and they will have input into the aspects of the report that concern them. And, for example, this year there's been an internet website in which citizens could put their suggestions for inclusion into the work report. It's mainly concerned with economic affairs, and I guess the main headline that there's been is that the Premier announced that this year China will be going from a minimum growth of 6.5%. They said that growth should not fall below that, and ideally it should be a little bit higher, but 6.5% is the target, and there are other important things on defense spending, on the need to tackle pollution, and so on.
So is China's economy still slowing? Last year's growth was 6.7%, the lowest for three decades. Does the 6.5% target announced reveal trouble for the Chinese economy?
Yes, growth is slowing in China, but I think it's important to understand that growth is still substantial. Growth, as you said, last year was 6.7%. There's now a target of a minimum of 6.5%, which is a minor tweak. Compared to that, growth last year in both the United States and Britain was at less than 2%. And there are various reasons for this slowing rate of growth. One of them certainly is, of course, that China faces economic challenges. But there's also the fact that China has been trying for some time, and this is very central to the current 13th five-year plan, to change its model of growth, to make growth more sustainable, to make less wasteful use of natural resources, to inflict less damage on the natural environment, to encourage the green economy, and so on. And there's also the question that as the Chinese economy, or indeed any economy, grows in size, the harder it becomes to sustain double-digit levels of growth. So that, yes, 10 years ago, China would have been growing in double figures, but what China is adding to its economy at 6.5% is the same as what it would have added in double figures some years ago. And the World Bank, according to the World Bank, for example, last year's growth in China accounted for one-third of all growth in the global economy, more than any other economy has done. Another example would be, even on 6.5% growth, if China's annual rate of growth was a country, it would be a member of the G20, because, in other words, China's annual rate of growth at 6.5 or 6.7 is equal to greater than the entire economy of Turkey, Saudi Arabia, or Switzerland.
Right. The Chinese economy, okay, it's 6.5%. And as you're saying, Keith, which I think is an important statistic to remember, 6.5% at this level of economic growth might be the equivalent of 10% or even higher at an earlier, lower stage of China's economic growth or development just perhaps in the last 10 or 15 years, I would guess. The United States economic projection is about 1.5%, I believe. Donald Trump says with his infrastructure program and deregulation of business and lowering taxes, et cetera, that he hopes to bring the U.S. economy to about 4% rate of growth. That seems to be highly unlikely. The United States had a rate of growth at about 7% after World War II, when the United States, which had 6% of the world's population, accounted for perhaps 50% of the world's production. That was, again, after the ruination of World War II. But the U.S. economy is so interconnected with the global economy. How does it impact if China's economic growth slows a little bit? And also, Trump is announcing or projecting or at least playing with the idea of possible tariffs against China. If he were to do that, China would retaliate, I would guess. It would be perhaps bad for both economies.
Well, the Xi Jinping and other Chinese leaders have said ever since this Trump phenomenon came up that there would be no winners in a trade war, and a trade war would affect all its participants. And clearly, if there are increased tariffs, if there are other economic measures taken by the United States against China, China is obviously going to have to retaliate, not even necessarily from a particular desire to retaliate, but in its own national economic interests. For many of the big ticket items that China buys from the United States, there are alternatives, be it for Airbus, for aeroplanes, Brazil and Argentina for soybeans, and so on.
Last year, China announced its lowest military budget increase for 6 years. It said its military budget would grow by just 7.6%. That's, of course, still considerable. But given the fact that China's military budget is considerably smaller than the U.S., it too is dwarfed, I would say, by Donald Trump's announcements that the U.S. would increase its military budget by $54 billion, or what is officially 10%. Talk about China's military expenditure. What's its impact on the overall economy? Because unless used, military production is in many ways waste production. Talk about that, if you would.
Well, as you said, last year's increase in military expenditure in China was 7.6%, which broke with a pattern of double-digit increases over a number of years. This year, it's been announced at the Congress that the increase will be 7%. One of the things that's worth noting on this is that the increase in defense expenditure is more or less in tandem with the rate of economic growth. As you've implied, China's overall military expenditure is less than a quarter of the United States. But China is not intending to go down the road of an arms race with the United States. The Chinese Communist Party has made some assessment of what it considers to be the causes of the Soviet Union's collapse. And one of them was that the Chinese felt that the Soviet Union had allowed itself to be dragged into an arms race with the United States that it couldn't win, and which served to bleed the Chinese economy. So China doesn't intend to go down that road. I was struck by a reported statement in the last couple of days by a retired senior colonel in the Chinese Air Force, who said about Trump's increases in defense expenditure, he said, $54 billion sounds like a lot, but the United States spent $6 trillion in Iraq and Afghanistan and failed to achieve anything. So I think the Chinese would keep a reasonable position of increase in defense expenditure without getting drawn into an arms race. Obviously, any socialist country or country aspiring to socialism would like to spend its money on developing its economy and improving people's living standards. But at the same time, China has said that it will spend sufficient to guarantee its national interests, and it will watch what the United States is doing in the South China Sea, for example.
Keith Bennett, not all the details of the budget are publicly available, but the South China Morning Post reports that, quote, in infrastructure, these are the words from the South China Morning Post, in infrastructure, China will pump 800 billion won into new railway works, 1.8 trillion won into roads and waterways and begin 15 major hydraulic projects, among other projects. Monetary policy would be, quote, prudent and neutral, that's in quotes, with the broad M2 money supply to grow 12%. Now, we know in the United States there are tens of thousands of bridges that are in disrepair. Some of them are really ready to fall down. There's potholes everywhere in this, you know, the richest country of the world, so to speak. Infrastructure projects take forever, even if Donald Trump says he wants to have a major infrastructure program, which I believe will be largely a program of privatization of waterworks and other basic public works. It won't have a meaningful impact on the economy for at least 2 to 3 or 4 years, and perhaps as many as 20 years for some of those projects. How does it work differently in China from, say, the United States when it comes to infrastructure?
Well, I think the first thing to be said was you said infrastructure projects take forever, and certainly that's my experience living in Britain. But in China, it's rather different. The speed with which China has rolled out, for example, its high-speed rail, its new airports, and so on, is quite phenomenal. I was struck by, I remember a remark that was made by Dilma Rousseff, the president of Brazil, when they were preparing for the Rio Olympics. And she was talking about building the metro system in Rio de Janeiro. And she said, nobody builds a metro system in 2 years. And they said, oh, except for the Chinese. And I think that was quite an astute observation. The other aspect of this is, of course, China has been engaged in this massive infrastructure build-up for a considerable time. So it's worked its way into the economy. But also that China has spent a long time in accumulating savings, which it is able to use in infrastructure building. And the Chinese economy is not based on immediate profitability, and payments to shareholders and so on, which are the dynamic driving a capitalist economy, don't really apply in China.
Right. So you have a situation where China's infrastructure projects really go immediately into high gear. In the United States, we have not only a bicameral system, unlike the National People's Congress, which is a unicameral system, but it's also a system that's largely gridlocked between Republicans and Democrats. That certainly was the case in the last 8 years. Republicans at the national level and even at the state level were turning down federal funds, say, for high-speed trains that would have linked the East Coast and West Coast of Florida. In other words, because it was Obama that projected the project, and they wanted it to fail, as they wanted all things that Obama was associated with to fail. There's not gridlock in the same way in China, it would seem to me. What you're describing is not simply a rubber stamp, though. There's lots of consultation. There's local people's congresses. There's feedback. At least based on what you're saying, there's an ample amount of democratic discussion. It may be differently organized than in the United States. But when the Chinese government makes up its mind that it wants to do something, it can go ahead and do it, unlike, say, the U.S. government, which has, because of federalism and because of the political gridlock between the two parties, can do almost nothing. What do you think about that?
I agree with you completely. There's not gridlock in China. Of course, there are issues of bureaucratic vested interests, issues of corruption, competition between ministries, and so on. So I think it would be wrong to say that it's all plain sailing and smooth, and there's no problems. I don't think that's the case. But there are, as you said, I think perhaps 3 points to draw out of this. One, the political system may not be democratic in a Western capitalist sense, but it doesn't mean to say that there isn't input from the people. There isn't discussion. But what's important is that, one, the basis of the political system is not meant to be adversarial along the lines that we see here in Britain or as you've described in the United States, where you had 8 years, as you said, of Republicans basically opposing things simply because the Obama administration was putting them forward. The system is not designed to be adversarial, but to be in pursuit of a common goal. And discussion is based around that. And when the decision is taken, then all the resources of the nation can, as decided, can be deployed towards that.
Yes, indeed. Well, it's an interesting discussion, and Keith, I hope you'll come back. We want to look at the outcome of the National People's Congress and other developments. Of course, U.S.-Chinese relations are also front and center now with Trump coming into office and shaking things up in the way that he has, the way that we already know about. Well, that's all the time we have. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.